Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Protests in Iraq, 6 months. Protests against the regime, not for reforms, but for regime change. Protests led by the young people of Iran, the future, against the mullahs, against their bullies, against the Basij, against the army, the IRGC, all the intrigue. Protests that are strong in the parts of Iran that are the donut, not the donut hole of Tehran, the Azeris, the Baluch, the Awazi, the in the south. West, where the oil is. All of those protests after 6 months, what is the measure? What has changed? I welcome Benham Bentaleblou, a senior fellow for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Benham, you have a lengthy and extremely helpful podcast in your comments about these protests, also conversations with protesters or people who support the protesters at great risk, not only of their own lives, but of their families as well. What is the measure of the protest after 6 months? What is the expectation of the next 6 months? Good evening to you.
Good evening to you, John. A great pleasure to be with you as always, and good evening to your listeners. It's quite clear that it's going to be getting worse before it gets better. The Islamic Republic, signals strength abroad when it feels weak at home. But when you look at the way the regime has actually dealt with these protests, be it those in Tehran, be it those in the center, be it those in the periphery, it's had a different cocktail of security forces and a different equation for repression each go around. And basically, because this regime retains a monopoly on violence, it has not been afraid to use it and has also weaponized what we call the injustice system. The regime has been trying to erode the will of Iranians to stay on the streets. Right now, we're going through part of the Nowruz holiday. That's a 13-day-long Iranian New Year, Persian New Year, that is celebrated not just across Iran, but in several countries that border Iran and in the ancient Near East. During a ceremony that led up to that, which is called Charshanba Suri, it's called Wednesday Night Fire, takes place on Tuesday night. There were many protests across the center and the periphery of Iran using this ancient cultural moment for the state to once again signal that it does not, for the street to once again signal its distaste for the state. But with all of that continuing to happen, the one question that Iranians have who are continuing to stay on the streets is, when will the West actually support us beyond words and translate that support into deeds? And really, that continues to be the outsized question as Washington dangles with a new deterrent posture against Iran in the region, but also continues to dangle the prospect of the JCPOA for the Islamic Republic.
I mentioned the periphery, the donut of the donut hole, the Azeris and the Baluch in particular. What is their status in the protests? Are those cities still seeing large groups of people protesting?
In particular, in Zahedan, in the province of Sistan and Baluchistan, Azerbaijan province in Iran, as you know, is split into two parts, East Azerbaijan, West Azerbaijan, where you've had a somewhat different coalition of protesters, given that there are Kurds in East Azerbaijan province as well. Just a reminder to the audience, these are provinces within Iran, not the sovereign state of Azerbaijan, which is just over the Aras River. But nonetheless, you've had high levels of street protests in the exact opposite ethnic minority pocket, which is in Sistan and Baluchistan province, and in particular in the city of Zahedan, which is the capital of that province. Like you mentioned a little bit earlier, the periphery continues to be one of the major drivers of the next 6 months of protests in Iran, if you will. But what's quite clear is it's not the only center of these protests.
The U.S. is deployed in Syria. Might seem fantastic. It is. Syria is a collapsed state, a failed state. It's been in civil war for decades, but certainly the tragedy of the civil war began more than a dozen, it's now coming nearly a dozen years. And the question is the civil war ended? No, it's not. The aspects of Syria being pulled apart include the most radical extremists, include the U.S. deployed to help the Kurds in parts of Syria. But recently, an attack on the U.S. deployment in Syria by so-called Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps affiliate. What does that mean, Benham?
John, you put your hand on really the heart of Iran's regional strategy, which is the export of their Islamic revolution through force. And the Islamic Republic calls the array of militia groups, terror groups, proxy groups, and partners it has either created or co-opted or today somehow controls across the heartland of the Middle East, the axis of resistance. So across the Iraq-Syria border, which many of these pro-Iran Shia militias actually control that passageway, including the highways that go across that border. Across that border, men, money, and munitions have long been ferried in the service of the Islamic Republic's regional projects. And as you know, striking at the U.S. force presence, wherever it is one of these regional projects. What you've seen under the Biden administration is Syria rise, or Syria grow as a new domain for this contestation, whereas in the Trump administration, it was in Iraq. So Iran-backed militias are firing more at U.S. force posture, more at U.S. bases, more at U.S. facilities in Syria now than in Iraq previously. So that means northeast Syria as well as southeast Syria. Under the Trump administration, Iraq really was the hub for where this political contest was taking place. The Biden administration likes to tout, of course, that it has a somewhat lower threshold for the use of force. But as you know, most recently, there was a U.S. Citizen that was killed, plus several others wounded in a recent strike by Iran-backed militias using a drone that had, again, telltale Iranian features. The U.S. responded with the use of force against targets along this border between Iraq and Syria. But again, the militias responded with a rocket attack. And so long as the response ratio to them escalating and us absorbing remains this way, there will be more, not less, proxy drone, mortar, and rocket attacks on our positions, whether it's on one side of the border or the other, and whether it's under a Democratic president or a Republican president.
Syria's darkness visible, so I don't have clarity here. I just remember that Hezbollah was the hired guns for Iran during the worst of the fighting in the cities in Syria. You reported, FTD, that Iran is still sending weapons to Hezbollah. Is this meant to threaten the U.S. forces in Syria, the Israelis, the Turks, the Lebanese? Why is Iran continuing to send weapons to Hezbollah via Syria, to stay in Syria or for a future conflict in the north of Israel? Can you interpret all this?
I would say, one thesis doesn't necessarily negate the other. But if I had to put my hand on one side of the scale, it's much more so to make Hezbollah an even more lethal military force that can function as the tip of the Islamic Republic's spear against Israel, which is, again, part and parcel of that regional strategy of exporting the revolution and arming, training, and controlling these proxy groups. So what they have vis-a-vis Hezbollah in Lebanon is this PGM program, the Precision Guided Munitions Program, where they help to take the quantitative advantages that Hezbollah's rocket arsenal has and grow them in terms of lethality by making a qualitative advantage. So adding control and guidance equipment to a rocket makes a rocket a missile. And if fired in a large volley, this could potentially overwhelm Iron Dome, depending on, which particular target Lebanese Hezbollah has in mind. So indeed, it is designed to put pressure on Israel from the north. But also, they've been trying to cement this highway that many have called the land bridge that connects Iran to Iraq, to Syria, to Lebanon, to ferry, again, men, money, and munitions across these borders that seem to no longer exist for the purposes of supporting their regional strategy. One element of supporting the regional strategy is to make sure Assad remains wedded to Iran and that Assad's forces continue to act and interact with Lebanese Hezbollah, as well as the IRGC, as well as the constellation of pro-Iran militias that exist in Lebanon today.
So the Hezbollah remain a surrogate force for Iran, hired guns, and they're deployed throughout Syria. Is that correct?
Indeed, and they have now the Lebanese state at their disposal, given how punctured that state has become to these men with an ideology and with guns from Tehran.
Now, because it's been too simple so far, we're going to get more complicated. Diplomatic relations between Riyadh, the kingdom, and Tehran, the Islamic Republic. Explain this in as many words as you need, Benham, because I'm confused.
Bless you. So... since the Biden administration entered office, Saudi Arabia began a bilateral private dialogue vis-a-vis the Islamic Republic that if one had to project a rationale for this, it would be severalfold. One, to basically ingratiate itself to the Biden administration, cement U.S. ties, whereas, you know, then candidate Biden had called Saudi Arabia a rogue state. And two, to try to find a way to close or bring the Yemen crisis to an end, given that Iran is the patron of the Houthis who continue to fire at Saudi Arabia, continuing to make that country mired in a long 8+ year war. So with all of that in mind, there had been around 6 rounds of private Saudi-Iranian diplomacy, mostly done through Iraq, mostly done with kind of former Prime Minister Khatami trying to mediate or moderate between the two. If I'm not mistaken, the Jordanians or the Omanis may have been involved in one round, but it was mainly done through Iraq. The Chinese, with their increasing political and economic presence in the Persian Gulf, basically hijacked this process, in particular with the President Xi's trip to Riyadh last December and President Raisi's visit to Beijing this January, and in essence inserted themselves into this kind of political normalization process between Saudi and Iran, and in essence made this look like a zero-sum outcome, meaning that it's a tick for the Chinese and Iranian bloc, and it's a loss for the Saudi and the American bloc. And in essence, what the Iranians are trying to do with public relations, not in material terms, but in public relations surrounding this deal that has come out, this Saudi-Iran-China normalization deal, where China, which buys the same thing from both countries, oil from Saudi Arabia and oil from Iran, is trying to tamp down, allegedly be seen as tamping down the prospects of conflict because, A, it needs there to be some modicum of stability for it to continue to extract resources because that country, China, is basically dependent on hydrocarbons from this region. I think more than 50% of China's oil comes from this region. So the Iranians are looking to make this label stick amid a region that was not born of any political vacuum. Given the Biden administration's lack of interest in pushing or furthering the Abraham Accords, and given the lackluster diplomatic pushback against the Islamic Republic in the region, the Islamic Republic is trying to say one thing, that Tehran beat Jerusalem to Riyadh. They're trying to signal that they are breaking out of the diplomatic isolation imposed on them. And in so doing, they may potentially extract some kind of other concession from Saudi Arabia. You know, some believe that the Saudis, if this deal goes through and if normalization happens, again, a big if, because this regime has never stopped acting this way, meaning it's never divested from its proxy strategy in the Middle East. So if the Saudis believe that the Iranians will genuinely try to cut ties with the Houthis or restrain the Houthis, they may have another thing coming. But ultimately, some believe that this could be driven by Iran trying to get Saudi to put pressure on some Saudi-funded media outlets. In particular, Iran International comes to mind, which used to operate out of London, but had a whole lot of threats imposed on it, including its staff and workers and employees there, because of the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps' long arm in trying to silence dissent, not just in Iran and not just in its near abroad, but all the way in a place like London, north of the European continent there. The trend line does not look good for the U.S. in the region. And this could be seen as hedging by Saudi, trying to ingratiate itself to Iran and Iran's patron to try to tamp down the prospects of conflicts. But the Iranians are trying to make a clear political point, and in so doing, force a divorce between Saudi Arabia and America over time.
Suspect nuclear weapons program. Benham Bentaleblou, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, returning to the subject of nukes, much in the news these days. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.